You're listening to FinTech in Focus, where our mission is to celebrate the talent and ideas that contribute to the global fintech industry. My name is Alyssa Callahan, and you're listening to this week's segment, Women in FinTech. Today, I'll be speaking with Aura Goldman, who's the CEO and founder of Mikorma, a leader in ERP software integration. Aura is a conscientious-centered business leader, mentor, and activist. As a leader in the fintech space for over 25 years, she's seen her fair share of challenges and successes. Through it all, she's come to care very deeply about leaving a legacy beyond dollars and cents. In this spirit, she built a nonprofit called One Act a Day, which focuses on making small, meaningful changes to improve human and animal rights and environmental concerns. Aura, first off, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today. So describe to me your path from higher education to where you ended up in the fintech industry.
Yeah, really, that wasn't exactly even anything on my mind at the time. But when I started college, I actually thought I was going to major in music. I played the flute all throughout junior high and high school and really loved classical music and started out as a music major. But after about a year, I kind of doubted my personal, like, although I had passion for it, just comparatively, I compared myself to others and I saw how dedicated people were to it. And I'm like, I don't know if I would make that cut, you know? So I experimented for a while. And after trying this and that, I even considered dropping out of school and just finding a job. So, well, that's when I learned that I didn't know how to do anything. Right? That's a rude awakening. I guess they call it adulting nowadays. So I went back to junior college and decided to take some businessy classes just so I could get a job. And the state of the art at the time was bookkeeping, typing, and I even took a shorthand class, believe it or not. I don't think that's even a thing now. And I took my first computer class. So that was back in 1981. And so it was before anyone did anything with computers. That's, well, some people did. But I realized I had a knack for it when I took that class. I had never even considered it before. And so once I did, I just was like, oh, well, I know what I should do. And I finished up a Bachelor of Science in Math and Computer Science from UCLA. And I ended up working for UCLA for about 6 years. And while I was working, I did part of a part-time MBA. I didn't end up finishing the MBA, but part of that. So that was a fun time.
That's great. That's such an interesting jump. It's funny that you say that because I actually played the flute in middle school and high school as well. And did consider going into music as well. So that's funny that you say that.
We'll have to find time to get together and do duets.
Definitely. So did you hold any other jobs or careers prior to finding your place in the fintech industry?
Well, I did work through college. After my, I guess, first year of college, I ended up first starting as an administrative assistant and just helping type reports and stuff like that. But by the time I was in my last year of college, I was actually doing software development part-time for a small company. And I also was tutoring math and stuff like that. And that's how I got through. And then I started at UCLA also doing software development. And I ended up there as the manager of operations, a computer facility. But I decided to freelance. So it was, when did I start? 1990. I left UCLA and I started freelancing as a computer consultant. I took anything I could get. I taught people how to use WordPerfect, which was the biggest word processor back then before Microsoft. And I was setting up TCP/IP networks for one customer. And then I was doing some custom software development as well.
And so you've kind of really... You have such a full, I don't know, resume of things that you've done and accomplished. Are there any skills that you found surprisingly helpful from one area that applied to your career later that were totally surprising to you?
Well, the truth is, I'll start with the most practical thing. Learning how to type has been a godsend. Like the fact that I can touch type and just talk to you while I'm typing. I mean, I honestly feel like, I type like I breathe. And so that, believe it or not, it's a small skill, but it's amazing when you can do that very reflexively. And then of course that I took the bookkeeping and a little bit of accounting in the MBA ended up being a very good skill. And I think that generally the world's always going to need accountants, so you can never go wrong learning some of that. And for me, it helped me get into the niche that I didn't even know was there with this fintech. That's not really something I looked for. It just kind of found myself doing it, you know? But the most important skill is personal development. That means like a long-term commitment to being a better person and learning soft skills, they call it, you know, how to listen, how to understand my own personal emotional triggers so that I don't go off and I actually can be consider things in sensible ways. All of these soft skills are really important for leadership positions.
Absolutely. Yeah. Just taking the time to invest in yourself is so important in any role that you take on, I think.
Yeah, I agree. Absolutely.
So what prompted you to make the switch from software development to business?
Well, I actually wanted to be in business at the time. It was an exciting time, you know, when computers were just springing up in the early 80s. Bill Gates had said, you know, he envisioned a small computer on everyone's desk, and people were like, what? You know, so but people were making these big splashes in the industry. And so I always had a little bit of that in me. And that's why I did sign up for business school and such. But I actually didn't view myself as any kind of entrepreneur. I was like, I wish I could be like that, but it's not really my temperament. And but I did have this ability to be a generalist, and I didn't know that that was kind of rare at the time. I could take a project from beginning to end. So that means like listening to what the customer needed, designing a solution, coding the solution, implementing the solution, teaching them how to use it, documenting it, and supporting it. And what I learned was, well, first of all, I wanted to grow. And so I had the idea of hiring people, which was helpful. But then I saw that not everyone does all of those things. I thought that was just natural, but that's just a particular temperament. Some people are really specialists. And so when I saw that, I saw, oh, I have to develop a company and learn how to lead something like that in order to actually serve the customers the way I wanted to. And that's how I grew into a business.
Right. Very much a Renaissance person.
I guess.
And how does your experience as a software developer help you to lead Mecorma now?
Well, I feel that having started in the computer industry, pretty much it wasn't exactly ground floor like in the 40s and 50s, but it was pretty early on with at least personal computing. And so I learned from the ground up in the sense of actually understanding what's happening under the covers from like circuit boards and then, programming languages and operating systems. I think that understanding all the technical layers and complexity really helps running a technical company, because when you see how these layers interact, you can envision how to build new things from them, and you can also communicate with technical people. And that's one of the most important things, being able to bridge from the customer to the technical. That requires listening on both sides, and also in a sense being a translator of sorts, because sometimes highly technical things are very difficult for, let's say, not the lesser or people that have different specialties to understand, and vice versa. Like the technical people don't necessarily understand accounting, and or that's what I happen to be doing is accounting, whatever the user wants. To be able to really understand that and be in their shoes and then bridge is super important.
Absolutely. Yeah, it is kind of interesting how there are different languages for the same products, just depending on where you stand in that whole, what's the word I'm looking for? I suppose just in that whole line of from development to getting in the hands of consumers and buyers.
It's really hard to communicate sometimes. And that's one of the things that I'm currently passionate about and working really hard to say, like, I can see how much automation that we as a company have been developing over the last, let's say, 5 years. There's been a huge transformation in capabilities. But to go from what we used to provide, which we're going to probably talk about further in our conversation, but to go from like a simple check printing to a whole AP automation, that's awesome. But then how do you get people to understand what you do? There's a lot.
Exactly. It's a talent. It's a talent to communicate that.
Absolutely.
On a more personal level, is there anyone that you looked up to or who inspired your personal growth?
Well, yeah, I would have to say that I had a wonderful ex-husband that also, always encouraged me, and we encourage each other to personal growth, and also a couple of dozen therapists, meditation teachers, body work and yoga teachers, over the years. I have invested highly in learning more about my inner world and also how to be the better person.
Right. That's wonderful. And I think, especially in this day and age, I think a lot of people are starting to tap into that and realizing the value in it. So that's really great that you're there to sort of be like, yes, this works, to work on yourself.
It's really been an interesting journey. So the other piece of it is connecting the inner growth with what's actually happening out in the world as well. Mm-hmm. And I can't say that I even started that way, because I'm actually fairly sensitive emotionally. And earlier in my life, I didn't have the capacity to listen to some of the things that I saw were happening in the world and then function in my life. I simply couldn't. It was too excruciating. But through developing over many years, I did come to the point where I was able to take in some of what was happening and go, wow, I really want to make a difference. And just in the last, let's say, decade, my personal development and then my ability to educate myself about what's happening in the world kind of converged and became the main passion. And I've been you had asked me about anyone that inspired me. Now in this last few years, what's really inspired me is finding a lively group of young folks and college students who have been immersed in activism and learning actually from them about social change. And I immersed myself into learning how social movements have made change in the world, starting with civil rights movement and going on to other kinds of causes, environmental or animal rights, and just understanding the things that are happening and also how you can make change.
Absolutely. And that's a great segue into my next question. So if you're comfortable with this, could you tell me a little bit more about your efforts in activism, and specifically in regards to the environment, human rights, and animal rights?
Oh, goodness, I would love to. It's kind of the thing, besides McCorma and besides my family, that's like the third tier of my triangle.
Your passion.
Absolutely. So it started out long ago. I always had a heart of like, how could there be poverty? How do you help people around the world? And also very concerned about like what I had learned about the criminal justice system. And so in earlier days, I started by making contributions to some of the charities that I knew about that were working in those areas and staying a little bit informed. And then about 20 years ago, I read a book and the title's pretty shocking. And so, you know, listeners can bow out for a second, but it's called Disposable People, Slavery in the New Global Economy. And just seeing that title was riveting to me. I was like, what? And I read this book and it had six case studies of people all around the world that were enslaved, and that, and it made me aware of how I'm part of a big system that supports that. And I started wondering what I could do. And I ended up founding a very small nonprofit. It's called One Act a Day. And the premise of One Act a Day is to make our systems more humane and more sustainable. And the idea was, with what could we think of that with small actions, if millions of people made these small changes, that massive change could occur.
Absolutely. And
yeah, thank you for that. And so we started exploring that. And if there's a website, it's a little bit dated, but the messages are timeless. And there's a few videos of projects that we did. And it will get resurrected, but right now I stepped back for a little bit. So what had happened was I had a chance to step back from Akorma for a few years, and this is where I put my energy. And now I've stepped in, and I am hoping to actually make Akorma be a company that makes a difference, and at some point, you know, bring them back together and align that and spread it out into the world. So what, as coming back, like when I started the company, my focus was more on, you know, personal success. And now my focus is on making a difference, success in making a difference, whether it be with Akorma or whether it be with One Act a Day, and hopefully with both.
That's absolutely great. I'll put the link to One Act a Day in our show notes. So then that way, if listeners want to go view that website, they can.
Awesome. So part of the reason I stepped back at the time I did from One Act a Day, after we had done a number of projects, was I stopped to consider, like, the premise itself. Like, I think it's a very catchy, the idea that if millions of people did small things that it could change. But, and I think there's something to it, but I also started to wonder if that was the whole story. And so I stepped back because I just felt like the system is so complex and intertwined that the answers might be a little bit more, a little bit more complex. And that's when my daughter got into animal rights, which I didn't fully appreciate at the time, but I was willing to listen to what she had to say. And I came to understand through studying that the exploitation that we do to humans and the exploitation we do to animals is really similar, and that humans and animals are both sentient beings that have feelings, and that we treat animals as if they're not, like they're just objects or things to own. And so I started realizing just how deep and broad the problem is, and starting to think that if we could change our attitude, like there's what's called intersectionality, which is where what we see as like racism or nationalism or, you know, something against immigrants or animals or environmentalism, all of these have intersection points. And so making a change in any has good impacts on everything. So what we're looking for is a ripple effect.
Oh man, I could talk with you about this all day. This is really, really interesting.
On that note, like imagine that every company that has this wonderful team of people that have learned to collaborate and make new things could spend some percent of their effort on how to make a positive ripple effect out in the world that's not just connected with their own, with the company's own profitability. So you can do your endeavor that you need to do for livelihood and create this positive ripple effect. And so that's what I'm, you know, that's what we're working towards.
I love that. And that's kind of how you're planning on running with Akorma going forward as well.
Absolutely.
That's awesome. I'm going to pivot the conversation a little bit to more of the fintech industry now. So when people think of the word fintech, they like to imagine, I think, software automation, because that's kind of the current thing that's happening right now and that's developing a lot. But really, fintech could be considered any technology that's developed over time to serve essential accounting needs. And you were part of the fintech industry before we even really had a word for it, when paper-based solutions were kind of cutting edge. What evolutions have you seen in finance technology over that time?
It's really funny because when you first asked me if I would like to be interviewed, I'm like, am I an expert in that? I don't know. and just to make the linkages between how things have evolved is very, very interesting. So when I was involved with McCorma way back in the 90s, we created what was called a Micker check printing solution. And the Micker check printing solution allowed you to go from using pre-printed check stock to using plain paper check stock. And the system would print the check face for you, including the 13B like special font at the bottom that makes it into a check, right? And the fact that the system could do that meant you no longer had to manage check stock and lock it away in a cabinet, and you could get signatures printed automatically. And it was just it really was a big way of streamlining your workflow. So ultimately automation is, that's what it is, streamlining your workflow. Now,
absolutely.
Yeah. So what's really fun is to be in a position now and say, oh, well, we've developed that system and we added security and we added an approval workflow and we added the ability for like what's called now robotic process automation, where it'll actually create all your batches for you and send them all out or send them all to the printer in one, in a couple of clicks, you know. And now we can connect to providers that'll do all the payment processing for you, and essentially you don't have to print checks at all. So
right.
It's funny to go from specializing in, oh, we could tweak your check printing process to make it easier, to, oh, guess what?
Yeah, you don't have to do it anymore.
It's wonderful. But it just keeps getting better and better, and we're really enjoying it.
Was there anything that you thought would take off but didn't? Or even vice versa, that did take off, but that you didn't think would take off in terms of financial technology?
It's interesting because, you know, I've been doing this business since 1990, so that's over 30 years. And over the years, definitely have tried several different launches of products that and had various success, for sure. But I think that anything that didn't take off, there were two reasons that came out. One is what we talked about already. Sometimes it's really hard to communicate with people what you have. And I think that's the art that we're trying to fine tune right now and really make that connection with people and be able to take what's actually quite complex, but get it to the point where they can take it in and have it register, you know? So we've had some false starts over the years with some, you know, GL-oriented products, or another one, the other side of it is going into the wrong system. Like we tried to bring our products to another ERP system and we didn't quite hit the mark. It was a little bit too small. It was oriented towards smaller companies, and that helped us realize just the niche that we specialize in and get more fine-tuned on that.
Right. That's the great thing I find about the fintech industry is it's so young. So a lot of the folks that are in this industry are really the explorers of, you know, learning what accounting people's needs are versus what we can provide. It's very interesting to be in this industry right now.
I think it's really interesting. One of the things I think about sometimes is the you know, one need that people have is to have a job, right? So it, when you automate their job, you know, that can be a thing.
The ultimate concern. Yeah.
It could be the ultimate concern. So I think that it takes time to transition because most employers don't want to just slash people to automate. They'd have to be in more of a dire straits where they had to do it. You know, not they don't do it really. Like they, you want to be able to reposition your staff to do more important things. So more higher level thinking tasks instead of just rote switching buttons. So that's one reason why people like to automate. And then, but I think over time, you know, staffs change, people retire. It's going to keep growing because it's simply there. But I think that is one of the trends that we have to look at is there's a hesitancy for various reasons. And that's one of them.
Absolutely. That's completely understandable too.
Yeah.
And are there any other industry trends that you think we should keep an eye out for?
Well, I think that the robotic process automation is a big one. The more that you can take what they call low-code environments, like Microsoft Power Platform, which lets you create automated workflows and take pieces out of your process that eliminate repetitive typing and button clicks. Well, that's amazing. I mean, it just streamlines the work. I don't like doing the repetitive things. I like it if the computer brings it to me when it needs me to read about something and then make some kind of a sensible decision so that it can move on to the next person or maybe review something and say, yeah, that looks right and move it on. So nowadays you can automate all those in-between spaces. And I think that's amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. And my final question for you is, do you have any advice for women who are in school or who are interested in joining the fintech industry?
Absolutely. I feel like this industry gives you both a benefit and a challenge in terms of having what I'll call a balanced life. Most of us, in order to succeed, we want to be balanced, meaning we want to succeed at work. We want to have a family or a personal life and good relationships there. And maybe we have some kind of hobby and we want to, you know, just take care of ourselves and be a healthy person, right? So for a long time, I've been able to work at home. We actually at McCormick started working at home in the early 2000s. So I think that's a huge benefit. You know, I didn't waste how many thousands of hours since for the last 20 years that I might have spent commuting. I haven't done it. I've been at home. And I think that's wonderful because all of that time can go towards self-care and relationships at home. But I also think that there's a challenge in it. And I didn't learn this for like a decade. So I want you to know it if you're just starting out. When you're working at home, it's super important to learn how to compartmentalize your time. And in fact, recently I learned a wonderful time blocking technique called Pomodoros, which you could look up, P-O-M-O-D-O-R-O-S. It's Pomodoros, and it's but there's many time blocking techniques. It's just one of them I happen to like. But the idea of compartmentalizing work time from family time, and also learning was hard for me of like if a family member needs me and I'm at home and they interrupt me, I used to get very frazzled by that, and I learned too late that that would have been good to have overcome because it made my family feel like they were intruding on me at work and that I wasn't available, even though I thought, oh, I'm working at home. I'm super available for my family. And I think I was definitely much more available than if I had been commuting to an office, no question. But there's like objective and then there's like the subjective part of it, right? And so learning that ability to shift gears pretty, like, maybe even say, look, I'll be available for you. Give me 2 minutes. And then centering yourself, you know, and then, okay, the kid's more important, you know? however that works in your life, that would be my biggest piece of advice, because I think that it pays lots and lots of dividends. Like, working at home already pays dividends, and then learning those two skills of being able to pause it and then being able to respond to the person right there in your room are going to pay off in the long run.
Absolutely. That's great advice and very timely too. I think, you know, I know that we're still working from home, and I know some people are returning to the office, but there's a number of companies who have, you know, realized the benefits of having their folks work from home. So that's very, very good advice. And I think I'm going to put that into practice myself. But Aura, thank you again so much for taking the time to meet with me today. I think you're such a fascinating and smart person, and it was really, truly a pleasure to talk with you and learn from you today.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity. It was fun.
Thank you for tuning into this episode. To be alerted to future Women in FinTech episodes or FinTech News and Views, which is hosted by my colleague, Ron Nachman, please consider subscribing to FinTech in Focus, which is available wherever you listen to your podcasts. If you have any questions or comments, please reach out to us at podcast@envoicepay.com. That's podcast@NVOICEPAY.com.